of the quiz tomorrow, and we want to finish reviewing for that today and then move on to the subjunctive a little bit more if we have time. Don't forget the reading from the last 2 weeks. Score yourself from 0 to 10 points on that. In other words, we're going on a basis of 5 minutes per day for 5 days per week. And, yes, Eric?
What a reading is that.
Well, I don't mind you doing a little bit of that. Part of the reason for the assignment is to try to get a fluency in your eye following it and your mouth coordinating with it. So eventually you're going to be working into more translating. If you want to do that for part of the time, I would do that, but I wouldn't take the whole time with that, just because we want to try to stress a flow, you know, and then actually when we actually start translating in class, we'll be going slow enough to do that, so we'll fill in that part there. But I'd rather just give you that just mainly to keep a familiarity and kind of forcing yourself to do more than you're able to comprehend for a while, you know, for part of it, and then maybe slow down and comprehend for part of it too. That'd be a good balance. Okay. Any other questions on that aspect? Okay, we left off around lesson 40 here on a review, and relative pronouns, relative clauses. Jim, question?
Mm-hmm.
231. Okay.
On the pronouns too.
Right.
Did you give the, or could you give the names again, like the nominative genitive do?
Oh, okay. Yeah, your nominative would be who. Your genitive would be probably whose or what's, I suppose. I don't know. How would you put it for a neuter thing? Usually you don't use it that way. Your dative would be to whom. Your accusative would be probably just whom, not the to. And then your plurals would be still, you know, the plural noun would be who, and then whose, and then to whom again, and then whom, and it'd be an understood plural. And the English doesn't have a different form for the singular plural, most of those. So, well, the neuter is more of what when you're getting what and to what and what whatever, you know, belonging to what, and then what for the accusative. It'd just be a kind of a neuter idea. In other words, inanimate objects, things that are not persons, are going to generally use the neuter. And the things that are persons are going to use the masculine or feminine. Okay. Any other question there? Sometimes, of course, you're going to have to tell by context, because the genitive and dative forms are the same for the neuters and for the masculine and feminine. So you're going to have to go by context in a lot of those to decide that. Just exactly which word you'll select in English to be the equivalent of that. Okay? Relative clauses. We talked about the relative pronouns. We've talked about the fact that the pronoun agrees with the antecedent in gender and number. We talked about the case situation. Normal pattern is that the case will be the case that's demanded by the pronoun in its clause, with the exception that there's a certain set of situations under which the case of the relative pronoun is attracted to the case of the antecedent, namely in instances where it ought to be an accusative case, but the antecedent was genitive or dative. So that's the one thing you need to remember with regard to that. Then there were just we were going through these next few sections, 310 to 316 or so, and there were specific points, detail points, that we looked at. We were up around section 317, dealing with other relatives. And we have relative adjectives and relative adverbs, primarily in this section. And they're pretty straightforward. The adjectives are declined pretty much like any other adjectives. Hoyos, such as, or as. And hosos, as much as many as. All who, or all which, or all that, depending on the context and what is a proper rendering that fits English. And those, I think, are pretty straightforward. It's a matter of vocabulary. So I would go through and be aware of those. We mentioned that last time. The third one here, hopu, where, that's an adverb, so that's not declined. Sometimes correlated with a k, where, there. In other words, where this is, there, that will be. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be. An example to give here. Who, meaning where, synonymous with hopu. So apparently just a shortened form of that. Then hosts, as, or like, and that's also a relative adverb. And it's sometimes correlated with futos. So you have as thus, or as this is, thus is this. So you have that interesting parallel. Usually the futos comes first. Thus I run, not as aimlessly. Thus I box, not as one beating the air, the example it gives here. Then hote, when, it's time-oriented. Again, it's relative. An hour when I shall no longer speak with you in figures and so forth. And here's a relative clause it's introducing. Hote is sometimes correlated with tota. When this, then this. So you see this interesting parallel also. See, a number of these adverbs set up this way. Then hoten, whence, or from where. So again, this is mostly vocabulary. So I would make a list of those vocabulary words or whatever you want to do when you're studying, or just take them out of the book here, but be familiar with those. This will be part of the test. Okay, coordinating conjunctions, chapter 41. This chapter is primarily vocabulary also. So I'm not going to go through in detail all of this vocab list again, because it does take some time, and you can do that on your own. I think it's pretty straightforward. The main thing just to draw your attention to is that the function of a coordinating conjunction is to join two grammatical elements of similar kind. And just as in English, the Greek can join elements, join two nouns together to form a compound noun, whether that be subject or object or indirect object or whatever, can join two verbs together to form compound verbs, can join two clauses together, can join two entire sentence structures together to form a compound sentence. So the basic idea is that they're joining things of similar kind grammatically. And that's what the first few sections are all devoted to explaining. And so you might want to review that part. You know, we see some examples in English. Two sentences, the boy washed the dishes, the girl dried the silverware. You could have the boy and girl wash the dishes, compound subject there. You could have the girl washed and dried the dishes, compound verb. The boy washed the dishes and the silverware, compound direct object. Again, the word and being used to join these elements of similar kind. And you could combine lots of things. The boy and the girl washed and dried the dishes and the silverware. There you have a compound subject, compound verb, and compound direct object. And then the sentence H here, the boy washed the dishes and the girl dried the silverware. There's two complete sentences joined by the conjunction and forming compound sentences. So that's kind of an introduction as to what English does on these things. Now, the Greek coordinating conjunctions are a lot more plentiful in number, and most predominant one is chi, of course. That's the one you're going to see most frequently, and so quite a bit of time is devoted to using the use of chi. Then we have te, the second one on page 244, its meaning is pretty much the same as chi. It joins two syntactic units and so forth, but it's the unusual feature there is that it's a postpositive. In other words, it does not stand first in its clause, and it doesn't stand between the two syntactic units, therefore, but it stands after the second one. So in other words, when you say this and this, the place where and goes is after the first word in the clause that's modifying, which is going to put it really after the second unit. The reason I try to generalize it to say it's postpositive is because it'll help get an analogy with a number of other terms. Basic meaning of te is and, is just as chi. And you have te, just like chi meaning both and. Most of this, again, is vocabulary, so I would just go through and review this. Particle A up there, and ada, with a smooth breathing, means or. Yes, question, Mark?
Yes, on the top of page 245, or tekai.
Right.
He says that it has similar meanings to teta and kai kai.
Right.
But he doesn't... I'm wondering if it meant not only and but also.
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it would mean that more than the others. I think many of the he's got down here under at the bottom of page 244, te te and kai kai can mean both and or not only but also, and it looks like. Tech High would fall in this. In other words, it would be a matter of context and kind of deciding what the meaning of the terms were and what would be appropriate. The example, for example, at the top of page 245, both the captain of the temple and the chief priests. It might also be not only the captain of the temple, but also the chief priests. In other words, it doesn't look like it's fundamentally any different than the other one, as far as that goes. But that decision would have to be made by context and, you know, what seems appropriate in English. And here there, it may go both ways pretty easily. See, you could, like at Acts 1:1, poiein tekai didaskein, you could translate that not only to do, but also to teach. So I think it would fit pretty much the whole gamut of things that were said in part two down there. Okay. Any other questions there so far? All right. The particle A is the word for or. And that's pretty straightforward, just like English. In comparisons, A means than. Better to marry than to burn. In Greek, of course, they only got one word for than or. In English, we have different words, so it's just a matter of English having different words here. Idea, though, I think you can see is similar. Allah is a strong contrast. That's when you're using the, now, kai and te can be translated but, and also de, too, which will come a little bit later on. But Allah is your real strong, unquestionable contrast. In other words, when you see Allah there, you know it's indicating contrast. And it's either rendered as, you know, if it's introducing something, it'd be however, yet, or nevertheless. There again, if it's starting a sentence, it's contrasting to something that's already gone before. So you still get this contrast idea, even if it's beginning a sentence. Okay, and then we have umonon ala kai, not only but also. Here's a very unambiguous way to state that. So if you really want to emphasize that idea without any question, you can use this phrase. Then ute, it's meaning nor. Mete, of course, is your form corresponding to the u and me distinction. Neither nor, so ute ute or mete mete. We have gar here, meaning for they were afraid. Yes, question?
Would you ever see either ute or mete, just ute, instead of the ute kind of combination?
Oh, just by itself? In other words, without the...
Just
the
kai, by itself. Without
saying
neither nor.
Yeah. The examples here don't do that. I'm trying to think...
In that kind of construction, you really can't.
Yeah. No, it doesn't look like you can very easily. Now, Greek may just do it differently than English. In English, we've got this neither nor pattern. Sometimes, though, I think we can leave the neither out if it's pretty clear from the context what we're doing. And I don't know whether Greek can do that or not. It's the only examples we see are the ones right here. So we'd have to check and see. You could probably find out fairly easily by looking up ute in the Greek concordance and then picking out the examples, and you'd probably be able to find and see if there might be one. If there were one, I think that it would be the same thing as in English. There was the context kind of decided. You got the idea from the context and the flow and so forth. So I can't say for sure whether you wouldn't see it that way. I just have to look and see the examples. Yes.
What is the difference between ute and mete and ude and mete?
Okay. The only difference is that ute is the form that's used. The u forms are the forms that are used with the indicative, and the me forms are used with the subjunctive or infinitives or participles, any other mood with the indicative. So the only reason to make a distinction is on that basis. Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking more between ute and ude.
Oh, I see. Ute versus ude. All right. That may be just a spelling variation. It may be just the same word. It's kind of hard. See, remember we had te and de. And they're pretty similar. I mean, they both got this idea of and. De is maybe a little bit weaker. You know, it's not quite as forceful. And so ute would be built from u and te, and the other one would be from u and de. And so that's that would be largely the essential difference, although they seem to be quite synonymous. I'm always a little reluctant to say totally synonymous, though, just because there may be sometimes even in English we've got words that you would look them up in the thesaurus and they'd be considered synonyms, but when you're speaking, you choose one or the other because it's got a certain nuance or a certain kind of a slight distinction that you're wanting to express at that time. And I think that's probably what you're going to see with these words too. It takes more feeling for the language to decide that, yes.
Yeah. I was wondering if you wanted to put the two different classifications when you enumerate the different food tables put in the first classification and food tables put in the second classification. I was wondering if there are any other functions they take or just that they are from the tail and which are in the two different.
Yeah, I think that would be your major distinction. I think the classifications you're talking about here is number one, the first type here, and most join any kind of grammatical element to any other grammatical element of the same kind. Then this classification two, where you find that and so forth, they serve to join clauses to indicate the connection of sentences with preceding sentences. That classification is mainly, you know, dealing with sentence structure and so forth. Gar, de, u, and so forth. They are more long-term or large. How do I say this? They're used to join sentences to the previous clause connections that way. So I think it's just kind of dealing with the range of use there. That may be our major distinction between those. But de, you see, de is kind of a te that's used for. Big sentence structures. Not that te can't be used that way too. It can be, because te can be used to join sentences as well as other things. But when you do it with te, you're going to get more of a compound sentence structure. In other words, you'll have, you know, no punctuation. It'll be a long, big sentence, and te will be joining two clauses together. And so you'll run it all together as one big sentence. Whereas when de is used, you may find a period here, and then ho de. Whatever, and the de is tying it to the previous, but it's not tying it so tightly that the punctuation is broken down. So, for the Hebrew students, for example, your de is more like this while consecutive type of thing, where you can even start a sentence with it and continue on. Although while consecutive kind of covers almost all of these, really, in a certain sense. Yes.
Sort of
dead,
just sort of coordinates
in
a looser fashion.
Yeah, I think so. It's just a def, a gar, un, ara, all of these, udef, medef, they all seem to be joining sentences with preceding sentences. In other words, you have a punctuational structure that isolates these in a sense, but yet the de or the un or whatever is connecting it with something that's gone before. And of course, now this gets to be a little sticky though when you really press the details, because if there was no punctuation in the originals, then who's to say, you know? It would be kind of a feeling that you get. Maybe what's happening is that the punctuation that we're putting in is based on the way that we're looking at, you know, these particular words, the kind of feeling that we get from them. In other words, these seem to be a little looser, a little weaker. Te seems stronger than de. And so these seem to be a little looser, and therefore the editors, when they see de, are likely to put a punctuation to close off the previous one. So when they see te, they wouldn't. Mm-hmm.
Out of all of these, is there any one of them that would emphasize
Well, let me just put it this way: the ideas that we find in Hebrew, that such a clearly set forth sequential narrative, isn't quite as clear in Greek. But if you're going to see a narrative like that, it's more like you're more likely to see de, because de would be. In effect, tying things together and kind of, it's a little bit looser, all right, but it's more sequential. It's more got the sequential idea, where you're not really trying to join things so tightly that everything is considered one unit. But it's a little bit looser connection, so that there is a joining, but they're not considered one unit, and that gives you more of a sequential idea. At least that's the impression that I've gotten as I've observed it. Now that may be something that would be worthwhile watching. The problem, one way to test it would be to see in the Old Testament Hebrew, where the New Testament is quoting the Old Testament, for example, and it's part of a narrative, to see how the New Testament translates the while consecutive construction. Yeah, or how the Septuagint does it. That'd be another way to check it. And so that'd be worthwhile to maybe check. The problem, you might have the Septuagint be, give you more data, because you could follow whole narratives that way. In the New Testament, you seldom have a real long sequential narrative that's been quoted, and that therefore it may not be as reliable as it could be. But that'd be worth checking into. And my suspicion is that you're going to see death more frequently than others, although I also suspect it may not be exclusive. In other words, that you may see other things used besides death. Gar you might see used even. Because Gar's got kind of this sequential type of thing, you know, for this. It's tying into what's gone before. These are some of the words that Don's always saying, you know, when you see a therefore, look and see what it's there for, you know. And usually it's going to be either un, de, gar, ara, one of these that is going to fall into that position, where it's a sentence that's starting off with something like this. And when we get to diagramming, you'll become very familiar with these words, because almost anything we pick out of the Pauline epistles, for example, is going to start with one of these things. There's going to be a de there or an un there or something, and you're going to have to put some dotted lines up to the previous context when you're doing your diagramming. Okay. So as far as distinctions between them, and the question that Eric came up with originally, that probably would serve to give us the best distinction, but then again, qualified by the fact that punctuation is something that was added later. And if we can go ahead and trust the punctuation, you know, that will help us. But I think ultimately we have to look at kind of a grammatical difference between the words themselves, just the way they happen to be used and what kinds of things they tie together. And I don't think it's too rigid, because you have this mend-de structure, for example, where within a sentence, parts of a sentence, you know, mend this and then de that within a sentence. So it's not so much that de can never be used otherwise, but it's major, you know, lines of distinction, I think, fall along those basic guidelines. Okay. Well, let's see. We have in this section, second section, then gar meaning for. You can pretty much just translate it for wherever you see it. I think it'll come out all right. I really haven't seen much of a range of translation on that one. And then de connects clauses between which some contrast is implied, or excuse me, when de connects clauses between which some contrast is implied, it should be rendered but, yet, or however. When there is no contrast, it should be simply rendered and. And again, this is something you'll have to determine by context. It's not the strong contrast that Allah is, but if the context is showing that, you can go ahead and do that. And the Hebrew students are familiar with wa consecutives too. There are times when you may translate it but, just because the context implied a slight contrast, but it was still sequential and so forth, and otherwise it fit into that mode. Okay. Oh yeah, no, that kind of thing isn't. No, that kind of thing doesn't apply in the Greek structure, just because word order of the clauses is not fixed. And in other words, Hebrew has some more rigid word order rules than Greek does in that respect. There's dekai, but also, but even, and also, and even, somewhat similar to tekai in a certain respect. And mendef, of course, that's one that you need to be familiar with on the one hand or on the other. Of course, that translation is a little bit stilted and a little bit awkward in some instances, but you've got this idea of contrast. And zeroing in on one thing and then zeroing in another thing. It's kind of an attention shift that's happening. You're looking at this, and now you're over here looking at this. Men this, and then dad this. So you're kind of shifting attention, I think, is maybe the purest idea involved here. And then if it's a contrastive thing, then you may say on the one hand or on the other hand. But otherwise, you see the one and the other. You see kind of looking at the one over here and then the other. Ho men, ho de. Some but others. You know, it's kind of a contrast, but it may not be an opposite. Yes, Mark? Something there? Oh, okay. Okay, men sometimes occurs without de. Kind of the de is just kind of dropped out, and then you still get the same kind of an idea of contrast. And you'll kind of feel that from context, too. languages tend to streamline sometimes, and if you set up a certain structure and you're kind of expecting the other, sometimes you can even eliminate the other and know what's going on. Un here is then, so then, therefore, consequently. Oh, question now?
How do you know which word then is present?
Well, it's usually the word that's following it. In other words, the one that's coming right after. If it's a verb or something, it may involve the whole clause. But for example, a couple of examples here. We wanted to come to you. I, Paul, did. See, ego men Paulos. I, Paul, did more than others. You see, I on the one hand, Paul. Kind of putting a little bit more emphasis on that. And so the word that follows men is the thing that's zeroed in on if it's a noun like this. The next example we have, tota men emenen en ho en topo. In other words, there, then he stayed in the place where he was for 2 days. So he stayed in the place. The emenen, emenen would be the verb form there, and that's the thing that the men is kind of putting some stress on. But like, you know, if you don't have a dad there, it's hard to really kind of translate it in a real clear way. And it's just kind of adding a little bit of emphasis, a little bit of contrast, you see. In other words, the idea is he stayed in the place where he was for 2 days, and afterward, on the other hand, on the afterward, he did something else. So he's kind of contrasting the two things that he did, and it was in the time sequence here. So in other words, you would normally expect a de to follow epete. Now de, on the other hand, is going to be postpositive. It's going to be following the thing that it's tying into, or at least it'll be the second element in the clause. That's the best way to put it. It'll be the second element of the clause. And you kind of have to look at the whole clause to see what it's connected with. Then men is frequently followed by un, and once so followed occurs without de. So men un. And then we go into looking at un by itself, and then he includes men un as a part of this. So un has got the idea of therefore, so then, therefore, consequently. And un, therefore, will also be used sometimes in what you'd see a Hebrew while consecutive narrative, you know, where therefore, because on the basis of what's just been said, this happens. So this can also give a sequential idea, but also can give a, you know, consequently, is, you know, there's your sequence, you know. Consequently, this happens. But cause and effect can sometimes be seen with that. On the basis of these previous things, this happened, or this follows. It's kind of a logical sequence that's being developed when you use un. So it would be pretty much analogous to our word therefore. Then with other conjunctions and adverbs, you have ara un, then men un. And men, again, just kind of got its normal sense. But when you put men and un together, you get a little bit more emphasis. There is a word, menun, written as one word, menunge, adding little particle ge at the end of that. They, of course, just keep adding emphasis. They just, every little bit, add a little bit more emphasis. Kind of funny. So you can kind of get a certain amount of emotion expressed or intonation. We do a lot of things with intonation that they would do with these kinds of words. And I'm sure they would add intonation on top of it, too. Yes?
To me, I think I would, instead of kind of putting it the way he has, perhaps since above he translates man, un, so, translate Romans 9:20, so who are you?
Romans 9:20, which... Oh, from Meninga. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes. So who are you? Yeah, I I think to translate it, who are you, maybe he's saying with stress on you, who are you? As long as you got that good intonation, you might do that. But I think if you're going to translate it in writing, you should do something like you said. So who are you? So then who are you? Who on earth are you? That's kind of a little stretching it. You know, I mean, you're adding some words in there. But I think what you've given would be about, the way I would probably do that. To get that manun get there, I want something there other than intonation. If you're doing it verbally, then maybe you can do it with intonation, say, who are you? But you can't do that if you're going to use it as a part of a text in a thesis or something like that. So there, I would want to express something like, so then who are you? Something like that. Mm-hmm. That's always something always to keep in mind when you're doing translating. What's the purpose of your translation? What are you trying to convey? Who are you presenting it to? How they're going to receive it? That's something always needs to be considered.
Yeah, you is already emphasized by the fact that you have the
pronoun. Right, you have the pronoun there and you don't need it. And
who are you?
Right. Okay, I think you got it there. Because su tis a by itself would be who are you? You know, you get a little emphasis on the you just because of the su is there. So manunga, and especially with manunga, you've got all three of those little emphases there, emphases. I'd want to have something there. Okay. Even there, the one above, manun, indicating continuity, so the church had peace. So it'd be all right, I guess, but so then the church had peace might even be a little bit better. So consequently the church had peace, something like that. All right. Then Uda and Meda are brought out, meaning nor and not, neither. And this is usually in the sentence, where your entire sentence is, or entire clause is being contrasted. Then you have Uda, Meda, Meda, neither nor, same kind of construction as before. So as far as the use of these is concerned, the Uda and the Meta and the Uta seem to be used in pretty similar situations. Although the Uta is more dealing with neither this nor this nor this nor this as far as a string of nouns or a string of verbs or something like that, whereas with the Uda and the Meda, it's just a string of clauses. And it may still be within a sentence structure, but it's like the entire clauses. Okay, subordinating conjunctions. This is the last chapter we had for review. This is relatively short. Let's just look at this first section here to see a distinction between these and the other conjunctions as far as function is concerned, and then the rest of it is, again, essentially vocabulary. Subordinating conjunctions may be divided into two groups, those which are always or almost always followed by the indicative mood and those which are always or almost always followed by the subjunctive mood. Now, lesson 45, which we're sneaking up on here, is going to be dealing with this other latter category. But the consideration of the second group is postponed lesson 45. The most important subordinating conjunctions of the first group are hoti, dot, hos, kathos, hosper, kathaper, epe, epe de, heos, hoste, and a. Now, and A especially is going to be seen in the lesson 45. Now, hoti is the most common subordinating conjunction, depending on its context, means that, or unstressed, or because. I guess he doesn't really talk so much about the difference between coordinating and subordinating here. Back in that previous chapter, he did. And just to draw your attention to that a little bit. Page 242. The subordinating conjunctions connect clauses to other clauses in such a way that one, the one introduced by the conjunction, functions as a subordinate constituent of the other. That is, as its subject or object, an adjectival modifier of its subject or object, an adverbial modifier of its verb, etc. So the idea there is a subordinating conjunction. A coordinating generally joins two. If you're joining clauses, you'll have two clauses that are joined together, and each of them could stand separately and give a complete thought all by themselves. Whereas a subordinating conjunction is going to introduce a clause that's a subordinate part of another clause. It'll be its subject, it'll be its object, it'll be an adjectival modifier, an adverbial modifier, or something like that. In other words, the function of that clause is tied in intimately to the previous clause, and it can't really stand independent. Some refer to dependent clauses and independent clauses. And that's kind of the distinction that we're seeing here. All right. So these subordinating conjunctions function that way. Hoti is one example here. Hoti means that when the clause it introduces has the function of a substantive. It is especially common as a means of introducing indirect discourse. So when you're going to make a whole clause into a substantive, and a substantive is going to basically function like a noun. So you're going to make a clause function like a noun. That noun may be the subject, it may be the direct object, maybe an indirect object, might be a genitive. It could be a number of things, but it's functioning like a noun. And as a result, indirect discourse is going to be commonly seen this way, because indirect discourse is something like, he said that. Now, he said that such and such and such and such is making the whole clause the direct object of the phrase he said. He said what? He said, and that would be your direct object. And then the whole T is now going to introduce a clause as the direct object. In other words, it's making the entire clause the direct object of the phrase he said. And so that's one special case of this kind of a function. Philemon 22 here, for I hope that through your prayers I should be granted unto you. Elpizo gar hoti dia ton. In other words, the thing, once you have hoti here, the entire clause is the direct object of the verb I hope. So the subject is I, the verb is hope, and then the direct object is this entire clause. And so this is a subordinate clause. It's a clause that's functioning as a subordinate constituent or a constituent part of the previous clause. And then the indirect discourse is given down here. But I say unto you also that you are Peter. So hoti sue Petros. All right. Hoti means because when the clause it introduces cannot have a substantive function and therefore must be adverbial. All right. This is the thing, and you may not even consciously be thinking about, do I translate it that or because? Once you see the structure and you start translating, it may just be automatic in your mind. You're not going to know whether to translate because or that. But the thing subconsciously that's happening is, if you can see that the clause is functioning as a substantive, you're going to translate it that. If it's not functioning as a substantive, it's going to be translated because, as an adverbial modifier of the verbal idea in the previous sentence structure. So is your eye evil because I am good? So we wouldn't translate it, is your eye evil that I am good? Sometimes in poetry in English you get strange phrases like that, but normally that would not be very communicate very much. Is your eye evil because I am good? Remember, it's the same word in Greek, so the Greeks aren't saying here it means that and there it means because. The Greeks are just saying hoti, it's hoti all the time to them, and they, when they learn English, they have to learn that we make a distinction between those. Okay, was there a question here, Eric? Did you have a question, Eric?
Yeah. I'm a little bit of trouble understanding the difference between a substantive function and adverbial function.
Okay. Let me think here. What would express it? If it's a substantive function, you could substitute a noun for the entire phrase and still make sense. In other words, I hope that... let's see. The hope isn't a very good verb there, because usually you have concepts there. You don't hope things. Let's use the verb see. Suppose we had a sentence that said, I see that you are a brilliant scholar. Okay. Now, in that sentence structure, the verb is, subject is I, the verb is see, and then the full phrase that you are a brilliant scholar would function as the direct object. Now you might have another sentence, I see him. There you'd have the word him as a direct object, and it's just a noun. But I see that you are a brilliant scholar is the same basic sentence structure, except that the phrase that you are a brilliant scholar, the entire phrase is in that position that him was in the other sentence. In other words, it's functioning like a noun in the sense that it is the one that's receiving the action. Now here, I hope that the action of hope is being received by this entire clause, and it's functioning as the direct object. So I think the main criteria is to look at your sentence structure, look at the main clause, and see where the holes are in the main clause. Now if you look at the next example, is your eye evil because I am good? There, is your eye evil is pretty complete all by itself. You see, your eye is evil. Is your eye evil? It's a question form, but in a statement form, it'd be your eye is evil. You have a predicate construction, you have a subject and a predicate adjective there, and that pretty much closes up the sentence structure. There's no need for anything else. Then the because I am good is not really functioning as a noun. It's it's an adverbial modifier. It's modifying the idea, is your eye evil, because the it's really modifying the verb is. And it's giving some more information on the ground that so forth. So it's maybe in a sense a subtle distinction. In other words, the phrase because I am good can't fit into a subject. It's not the subject of the verb is. It's not a predicate nominative. It's nothing that a noun could fit into. And I think the main thing is they started with the substantive function because it's kind of a process of elimination. If it doesn't fit into the one, then you fit it in the other. In other words, you can't fit it clearly into a position where it's the direct object, it's a genitive phrase, the object. Now, I should have mentioned object of preposition. Substantives can often be object of prepositions, and a ho-t clause could be in that position too. But if it's not in an obvious noun type position, positions that nouns can occupy, either a subject, direct object, indirect object, genitive phrase, or object of preposition, then it'll be one of the, then if you've eliminated all of those, it's this other one. Now, usually, like I said, your mind will do all those gymnastics without you even thinking about it. And you'll say, oh, it's got to be translated this way. It just doesn't make any sense the other way. In other words, if you try to translate, is your eye evil? Is your eye evil because I am good? If you try to translate that, is your eye evil that I am good? It wouldn't make sense in English. And conversely, if you take the previous one, say, for I hope that through your prayers I shall be granted unto you. It's for I hope because through your prayers I shall be granted unto you, and it wouldn't necessarily fit. Sometimes it might. Sometimes it might be a gray area. That because might work there, but he's not hoping because through your prayers I shall be granted unto you. At least not. That's not the sense that he's bringing from the context. In some situations, it might be possible to hope because somebody's praying for you, and then therefore you have hope. But in the context of the flow here, it's not a cause and effect relationship, and he's hoping that this will happen. So sometimes it gets subtle, you know. Sometimes, and there can be some arguments about it too, because in some instances, a given clause could fit in English. It could fit as a substantive. Or it might fit as an adverbial modifier, and that's where you have the biggest ambiguities. Then you have to resort to context and other things to decide it. Okay, Glenn?
Well, I was just noticing that in the last 2015 example, it's got the equative verb there, so you can't take a direct object.
Right.
And
yeah.
In the Psalm 22, it's missing the direct object, so that's why it can be the direct object.
Mm-hmm.
If it had a direct object in there, could you just stick the because on the end of that?
Yes. Sure. Yeah, that's another thing. If the sentence structure is complete already, and it's got its direct object and so forth, then the thing is going to fit into that position. But remember that substantives can be, it's not only direct objects. Sometimes it may be the subject of the sentence. In other words, you might have that I am here is proof that such and such. You might have the full phrase that I am here as the subject of a predicate construction or something else. So that can happen. I suppose most frequently a clause would be fitting into a direct object position. That would be your most frequent, especially when you consider that indirect discourse is going to be one of the most common uses here, and that's going to be a direct object function. But that's a point there. This equative verb can't take a direct object, but an equative verb could take a predicate nominative, and it is conceivable to have a sentence structure. It's conceivable to have an equative verb and have the ho-t clause be the predicate nominative of it. I don't know if it actually occurs or not. I can't think of an example, but it would be conceivably possible for that to be a situation.
Your eye is because I am good.
Yeah, that could be. Your eye is because such and such. Now, that would your eye exists. God could say your eye exists because I am God and I created it. No, that would be an example of what I mean there. Okay.
Go ahead. Putting it in the subject position, you know, that I am here, that or not.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we can do that in English and put that back there.
Uh-huh.
But it demands an equative verb there too. That I am here is the reason, you know, or something like that. Would they actually see this poetry used in that kind of construction, or are we just sort of?
Well, we might be projecting backwards. I'm trying to think of examples. I can't think of examples of a ho-t clause being used in a substantive position. They may, there'll be other particles and so forth that are used that may fit into that position a little bit more appropriately. But within the rules and so forth, there seems to be a possibility that you could see a Hoti in a position like that. It may probably, you know, I've been thinking of the text and so forth, and I can't think of examples where Hoti is used in the subject position, but that doesn't mean there aren't any. It seems a little strange. It sounds strange to me. Yeah, and that's sometimes how you pick up things. That sounds funny, you know. But normally direct object or predicate nominative, that wouldn't be too difficult. Object of a prepositional phrase, things like that would not be difficult positions to find this in. Okay, Hoti sometimes, he mentions here, introduces direct discourse. When it does, it should be not translated, but, you know, used as quotation marks. So this, again, is kind of an interesting thing in English. And you have to look at the context to find whether the speaker is actually speaking or whether it's referring to a speaker speaking, because in Greek, Hoti will be used for both indirect and direct discourse. In context, we usually have to decide the difference there for us. If you decide that it's direct discourse, then you may want to, instead of saying that, put quotes there. Okay. D-O-T is just adding D-A onto Hoti, and that means because or for. And if context may be permitted, permits it may be rendered by therefore. So it's got the idea of through what. Through what. If you think of it through what, then it pretty much comes straightforward. Through what. You just get the idea of because. And occurs much less frequently than Hoti. Then we've got hos, meaning as, kathos, hos per, katha per, just as. Used like their English equivalents. So the rest of these are pretty much a parallel to English. And that's essentially vocabulary then. It's kind of hard now to make a difference between these. That's something that would have to be done. Somebody wanted to do a study on that and see if there's a slight nuance between kathos, hosper, kathaper, for example. We mentioned that before, I think. Epe and epeide correspond to English since, usually not in the temporal sense. In other words, not since this happened, you know, it's been 15 years since such and such. It wouldn't be used so much in that sense, not so much time, but in the sense of cause and effect, because since this happened, then this happened, or because this happened, that kind of an idea. Heos, until or while, it's got more of a time sense to it. And so until the flood came or while it is day and so forth, you have to kind of look at the context a little bit there too. And then hosteth, so that. Again, this resultative idea is essentially the idea of that. So that. If context permits, it may mean therefore. Well, therefore is kind of the same idea. So that. In therefore, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath also. You have to kind of look at context again for the causal connections there. And there's lots of room for more study in some of these things and fine points, of course. Yes?
Is this a combination of hos and
teh? It looks like it is. That's usually what you're seeing here. Hos meaning as, teh meaning and as this, so that, you see. There can be a connection there, I think. Okay. Kind of going by analogy there to determine that. So that's mostly vocabulary, yes.
I just want to mention, I read a little bit today in an answer on this conjunction, and regarding the conjunction soon.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to have just written a doctor's thesis on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a very long article.
Did he? Good.
About all the different meanings.
Uh-huh. Was he dealing mainly with just the different meanings of un, or did he contrast it with other conjunctions and say, you know, this is used in this situation, whereas the other one would be used in the other? Do you remember?
Just there was more dealing with meanings, because of enumerating the different meanings, both have different contexts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It is a very interesting, and many of these are very interesting words. Some of them are used frequently enough where you can gain some, you know, pretty good insight into the range of use. Others are not used frequently enough to really glean a whole lot. So these are fair game for any of you that want to do your grammatical study, you know, in contrast. And especially what I'm interested in is contrast between this and that one. In other words, comparing, say, a series of ones that are generally regarded as synonymous to see if there's particular situations which you find one versus the other. Those are very interesting types of studies, isn't it? I haven't seen much of that kind of thing done in a lot of the textbooks. Like in most of the things, it's, you know, they'll give you the range of meaning of this particular word. Then they'll give you the range of meaning of this one, the range of meaning of this one, the range of meaning of this one. But not a whole lot of guidelines as to what circumstances you would expect to find this one, what circumstances you expect to find that one, and so forth. And those are things that, of course, would be a lot harder to deal with. So I'm not giving you easy, you know, suggestions here. This would be hard stuff, but it might be worth doing. Some of it you may come up with dead ends too, you know, just not enough words to decide, you know. And then you'll have a little bit more sympathy for the guys who wrote the books. Okay, so something good will come out of it. All right, that's the last bell, so be prepared for the quiz tomorrow. Oh, that's the first one? That's right, that clock is throwing me off. Are there any other questions that concerning the test tomorrow? Like I said, your translation will be from Greek to English, so I won't be having you go from English to Greek. So it shouldn't be that difficult. And, yes? Not a lot of old material. Most of the grammatical questions are right within these chapters. The test will be lots of grammatical questions and then some translations. And I'm not really looking for obscure points from old material. I expect you to be familiar, you know, with basic... and vocabulary, I'm not going to be using words I don't expect you to know. If you've got a pretty good grasp on the vocabulary, not the, you know, real obscure words. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, pretty commonly understood words that are used at community chapel frequently, you know, that kind of thing. It's hard to, you know, unless I tell you what words I'm going to give you, you know, it's hard to say much more than that. In other words, I don't expect there. Now, there've been some words that have been introduced here. Things that are new are, you know, like the numbers, the declension for the numbers, you know, these various conjunctions and so forth, that kind of thing. Part of it will just be vocabulary of some of these conjunctions, obviously you'll need to know those. But as far as the sentences are concerned, they're pretty simple sentence structures, and I'm not really trying to search out a lot of complicated grammatical points from the past. I'm trying to focus more on stuff we've had in this chapter. But you do need to be familiar with your basic declensions and recognition of them, at least. I mean, you ought to know that you're looking at a second declension noun that's, you know, used as a plural or something. Yes?
For indirect questions, how do you want to translate that? Literally or...
I see. With the verb forms?
Yeah.
I would say go ahead and translate it in the English mode with that verb change. But then if you want to put in parentheses literally, that's kind of the way I like it done. The way I prefer it done is to translate it in a good English way, but then put a parenthesis to say literally this, just to show that you picked up the fact that the Greek is using the same verb form. And that to translate it real literally would be a little stilted for English. But I still like to kind of see the, you know, the Greek thought there too. So that's kind of a good rule of thumb. When you're in doubt about something like that, put down a good English translation, and then if you feel like, you know, my view is I want to see that you got what the Greek was saying and didn't just gloss over and miss something. So if you put in parentheses literally such and such, then I can see that you've got the literal thought in the Greek, and then you're putting it into an English translation that's appropriate. Okay. Anybody else with a question as to what's likely to happen to you tomorrow here? It's a relatively short quiz. I don't really think it's going to take very long. It's only a couple pages. And hopefully we'll all finish it and be able to correct part of it in class, but we'll see. I'll give you a full hour if you need it, though. Okay. Good. Well, we left off in lesson 44 as far as our progress through the book is concerned. We're just finishing up this chapter on the subjunctive. And then there's another chapter on the subjunctive. I'm not going to give any assignments for tomorrow, of course, because you have a test. So we'll finish that up after the quiz or on Thursday and then get into chapter 45. Chapter 45 is a little bit more difficult, a bit longer, and it's going to be dealing with the subjunctive and certain clause constructions. and hina clauses, for example, one of the most important things, and we'll be looking at those, and conditional clauses and the various types of conditional clauses. We'll find type A, type B, and type C conditional clauses, which will be kind of interesting. These, of course, are just categories that they came up with here for looking at the types of situations depending on the verb forms that are used and so forth. Well, that's all for today. We'll take the test tomorrow and then see where we go from there.